Hi, welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 91 for May 13th, 2007. Coming up in a few minutes.
We want to do it right, build an extremely strong, firm foundation to build in for the rest of time. History of bourbon.
That's Jim Rutledge, the master distiller at Four Roses Distillery in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. More with Jim later, but first, let's look at the news. The Spirit of Speyside Whiskey Festival is over now, but the finale came last Monday with the announcement of the Spirit of Speyside Whiskey Awards. In the 12-year-old and under category, the Glenlivet First Fill took top honors, while Craganmore 14 won the Teenagers category for single malts 13 to 18 years old, the 21 years and older winner, a 30-year-old expression from Glenmurray. For years now, the only way to get a taste of single malt from Speyside's Ardmore Distillery has been to go through Gordon and MacPhail, which had the blessing from Ardmore's owners to sell independent bottlings. Almost all of Ardmore's output goes into the Teachers blend. Beam Global Spirits and Wine took over Teachers and Ardmore 2 years ago as part of the Allied Domecq breakup. Now there are plans to release an official distillery bottling of Ardmore as a single malt. That's according to the folks at JustDrinks.com. I'll have more details on availability as they become available. Meanwhile, two different whiskeys are being scaled back and in one case dropped altogether. First, Diageo has killed off the J&B -6C blend. This one was designed to attract new whiskey drinkers and was chill-filtered down to 6 degrees below zero. It never really caught on with its target audience. Early last week, the Scotch blog reported that Edrington-backed John Mark & Robbo's Easy Drinking Whiskey Company was pulling out of the UK and other markets. Give Toronto-based blogger Sam Simmons and the Scotch blog's Kevin Erskine credit for breaking this story. JMR's Mark Geary confirmed in an email this week that the brand will be focusing on the U.S. market exclusively with its vatted malts. The change comes after Robbo, Dave Robertson, left the company last year to join White & Mackay. There are still stocks available in some UK retailers, but when they're gone, they're gone. Back to Sam and Kevin for a second. You've heard from Kevin Erskine many times here on Whiskey Cast, but I'd also like to point you to a couple of other blogs that you might like. Sam Simmons publishes the Dr. Whiskey blog, where he offers up his tasting notes and opinions. And if you're into Japanese whiskeys, Chris Bunting has a blog that you'll want to check out. It's called Nanjata, and is one of the best resources I've seen on the web for learning about Japanese whiskeys. By the way, Chris explained to me in an email that Nanjata is loosely translated from Japanese as drunk at all. Nice name. Sam, Chris, and Kevin have all been kind enough to offer links to Whiskey Cast from their blogs, and you'll find links to those blogs on the Whiskey Cast website. One of the questions that comes around this time every year, it seems, where's the latest edition of Jim Murray's Whiskey Bible? Well, I asked Jim that question, and the answer is simple. He's taken publishing of the Bible in-house this year, and that means some growing pains.
The website's actually been absolutely inundated with orders, which I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know if it's bad because it means that we're not getting into the right places, or good because it means that people are using the website. It's hard to say which, but we have been absolutely bombarded, and we are sending out books, you know, by the bucketful, day after day after day. They're going everywhere. We've got them into more places around the globe than we have before, but we are completely rebuilding the network in who takes the books, because before it was all done on a kind of a, you know, friendly ad hoc basis. Now we're setting down very, very firm foundations so that the Bible can grow around the world. It's quite exciting times. And I do apologize if people are still struggling to find it here and there, because, to be honest with you, the whole network, the whole situation of selling books into places like, for instance, North America is very complicated. There's so many different avenues in which you have to go down, and we're using three different avenues. We're using the big bookstores, the smaller bookstores, and the liquor stores, and we're having to find ways of dealing with all those three levels on a basis now that keeps us going now, not just year on year, but for the next 5-10 years. It's a lot of enormous work is going into it here, with extra staff being taken on, so on and so forth. But it means slightly, I'm afraid, that the website has had to take a bit of a backseat as far, because I was actually going to be bringing it out as a magazine, and we've just not been able to do that because we've had to build the we've had to build the empire, if you like, of getting the Bible out around the world. Once that's settled, and once I've got the management team in place here who can get on with that, then I can get back on with getting to the distilleries as I was, getting back to writing about it as I was. But at the moment, I'm just absolutely making sure that the Whiskey Bible is in totally and utterly secure hands, because that, as you probably know, Drumgood Books, my company, is now publishing it around the world. And we've got to make sure that it's being done right. So if people are having problems, I apologize. But if you contact whiskeybible.com, you can order through there.
Jim is already making plans for the 2008 edition of the Bible and hopes to have it into stores in time for the holidays. There'll be plenty of whiskey events between now and then, and looking at the calendar of events, the London International Wine and Spirits Fair starts May 22nd. Fays Isle, the Isle of Festival of Malt and Music, runs May 26th through June 3rd. The Highland Whiskey Festival is June 2nd and 3rd, and the Kentucky Bourbon Festival's Frankfurt Sampler is June 16th. It's a taste of what you'll find when bourbon lovers hit Bardstown in September. Last month in episode 86, we heard from Jim Rutledge of Four Roses about his bourbon's debut in New York. It's the first time Four Roses bourbon has been available in the U.S. outside of Kentucky in decades. There's much more to the story behind Four Roses.
Four Roses was one of six bourbons, going back in history a little ways, that legally was producing bourbon during our Prohibition era from January 1919 through December 1933. Bourbon was being produced for medicinal purpose. When Prohibition was lifted at the end of 1933, Four Roses quickly became the top-selling bourbon in the United States, but more than that, it was the most recognized name in distilled spirits. Because of the recognition and the renowned name Four Roses, the giant in the distilled spirits industry, Seagram, purchased the distilling company. They got four other bourbons, five or six blended whiskeys, some gin and vodka, but they were after the Four Roses name. Seagram was a Canadian corporation, primarily a blended whiskey company. They introduced in 1945 a new blend of whiskey to add to their portfolio of brands and named it Four Roses American. Instead of Four Roses Bourbon, under our logo of roses, it said Four Roses American. It was a blend of 100% American whiskey. It was a very good blend of whiskey back then. By the end of the 1950s, the blended whiskey was doing over 250,000 cases annually in the U.S. Four Roses Bourbon was still the top-selling bourbon, but Sam Brofman / Seagram made a decision then to remove the top-selling bourbon from the domestic market, focusing in a potentially explosive export markets. Since 1960, Four Roses disappeared from the United States, Four Roses Bourbon. And with the top-selling bourbon in most of the mainland European countries, also in Japan, as you mentioned. But Seagram went out of business at the end of 2001, giving us an opportunity to bring a bourbon back to the United States. First thing we did, and I'm a bourbon distiller, understand that, was kill that Rotgut brand with our name on it that wasn't our product, and we stopped production. We recalled everything around the country that we could get our hands on, making preparations to bring the bourbon back to the U.S. As I mentioned earlier, we started slow. We didn't have the barrel inventories. When Seagram went out of business, we had the inventories to support our strength markets in Europe and Japan. So we had enough to come into one market. That's why we chose Kentucky, as I mentioned earlier. Now we've got our inventories to a point that we can begin to go slowly into other areas. And we're going slowly for another reason. We're more concerned about where we we will be positioned in 10, 15, 20 years from now rather than selling a lot of cases next year. We want to do it right, build an extremely strong, firm foundation to build in for the rest of time, history of bourbon. And so we're very happy with what we're doing. We're happy with the progress it's making in the United States, and we're extremely excited. I am ecstatic about being in New York right now and really looking forward to going to other markets.
Tell me about your history in distilling. How did you get involved in the business?
My family was not in the distilling business like some of the other distilleries. When I graduated from the University of Louisville, I was actually offered two positions about the same day, I think. One was in with Seagram Distillery and in Louisville plant. One was with a tobacco company. And I thought about it for about 10 seconds and decided to go with the distillery, and it sounded fascinating. I knew nothing about it. I had a business and a chemistry background, so I had science, and I love the idea of getting into the distilled spirits business. I started out in the research and development department of Seagram, stayed there for a while, and then I actually spent time in all areas, all facets of the company, the production end of the business. I love my time as a swing shift supervisor in the distillery, actually making bourbon. After a while, I spent some time actually here in New York in the corporate offices, and every year I was always, when are you going to let me go back and do what I really, really love? And in 1992, I went back to Kentucky, and I've been there ever since and loving it. And right today, I love it more than I did when I started 40 years ago. Been in the business since November 14th, 1966. I remember the day I walked in, and it was a great day in my life, and I've loved every day since then.
What's the best part about this business? Is it making the whiskey? Is it the people? What is the best part?
I have to say both, really. There's let me just use an example in the process itself. We've come light years, I feel like, in technology since I started back a little over 40 years ago. But there will always be that element of art. The fermentation, where all alcohol, whether it be beer, wine, bourbon in this case, is made, you need just sugar, food source for the yeast, and water. But if you were to put single space every chemical equation that takes place on one piece of paper, probably stretch 8 feet long. And there's a lot that takes place in it, and that's, to me, that's part of the art. To be able to walk up to a fermenter that takes a little over 3 days for the yeast to consume all of the sugar as a food source and generating alcohol. But to walk up at any stage and using my senses of sight, that's first thing I'm going to do is look at the top of the fermenter, how it's moving. Don't want to see a thick crust on the top because that's too much bacteria. Then taking a handful of the air right above the fermenter to smell it, sticking my finger in it, tell about what the temperature is, and tasting it. And then the fifth sense, just play on word, I've got to listen to what all those other senses are. And I could usually, even though it takes 78 to 82 hours, I can usually guess, it's not a guess really, within 30 minutes how old that fermenter is at that time, and is it right or wrong? If it's not right, what do you do about it to fix it? And that's the art that will always be there. Now, the people in the industry, they're the greatest. All the distillers, there's 8 major distilleries in Kentucky. That's all the stuff. When I started, there's still probably close to 100. But there's 8 major distilleries. All the distillers were friends. We help each other out at the drop of a hat if somebody's having a bacteria problem with their yeast or with their fermentation or there's a problem with the grains. We do anything to help each other out. We get together for dinners or lunch now and then. All the distiller will bring one of our bottles with us, but we can't drink our own. So we're friends, and you wouldn't see or would never see the camaraderie I think we have in our business, in our industry. You wouldn't see it in the beer or the wine industries, but and at a different level in distilled spirits. You get up in marketing sales, it might not be the same, but the people who really make bourbon, we love what we do, we are passionate about what we do, and we're all in the same boat.
Four Roses will be expanding into other U.S. markets over time, but you can always find a bottle by visiting the Four Roses Distillery in Lawrenceburg, There's a link to the Four Roses website at the WhiskeyCast website as well. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2007, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.